Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for a tech update with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, talking about keeping personal data safe on your computer, your tablets, your smartphones. Jesse LeGrue is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. So as we talk with Jesse, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about increasing your personal cybersecurity? How can you find out if your data has been accessed by hackers? What other questions do you have relating to IT? Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jesse LeGrue, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
Well, we learned last month that a massive data breach at a background check company named National Public Data was hacked. The data breach may have compromised personal records of as many as 2.9 billion people. What more do we know about the incident?
Yeah, there was, I think right now we're really trying to understand more as they perform their investigation, exactly who was impacted. A lot of people are curious, is my data impacted? What should I do? And so far, National Public Data hasn't notified any individuals. I think based on the reports that I've seen so far, it's a little bit more unknown how or if those individuals will be contacted. Many times these kinds of investigations can also take weeks, if not months, for a variety of reasons. And so a lot of people are still wondering, you know, whether their data was impacted. There are a couple of sites out there that may help people identify whether their data was impacted in that data breach. But I think that's one of the biggest questions people have right now is, was my data in there? What should I do? And, you know, could this happen again in the future? Which, unfortunately, the short answer is yes. A lot of people have our data right now.
And the information, I mean, it may have included social security numbers, full names, addresses, information about relatives. So, and this happened in what, December, wasn't it?
Yeah, December of 2023 was when they believed that initial breach happened.
So, you know, there are two websites that people can go to. One is npdbreach.com, and the other is npdpentester.com. I went on the sites, all right, and took a look to see what might have been taken from mine, and I think my zip code was taken, and that was it on npdbreach.com. I couldn't get on to Pentester. I got on, but I couldn't see anything on Pentester.com. So my zip code. So I don't know. Is that a big deal?
Yeah, there's probably not a lot somebody can do with the zip code. Granted, you know, when we look at how we use technology every day, how is that information potentially used? So could a zip code be sensitive? A lot of times online orders or even in-person purchases using credit cards might actually ask for your zip code. So it could be one of those data points that gets somebody closer in order to being able to make a transaction in your name. But even with that, you still need other information. So is there a risk? I mean, kind of. A lot of that information can be relatively easy to get depending on public data that's available. I think one item that I did find surprising, I shouldn't have found surprising, but I did. I actually had a coworker stop by my house. I'm like, how did you even know where I lived. Like, I don't think I gave you my address. I wasn't, you know, particularly concerned whether they had it or not, but they had found it actually on public tax record information and property information. So there's a lot of pieces of data about us as individuals, you know, whether we own property, where we're physically located, that actually may be already available in public data sources, unless we decide to opt out of having that information publicly searchable. So that could be county, city, or state tax records, and a variety of other pieces, locations. So may not be an easy Google search away, but if you know the right location to start, you can actually get that some of that information pretty easily.
Mm. I know that a lot of people using these sites, npdbreach.com, and we'll have links up on our, Joel Patnott, our producer, will have links on Larry, WPR.org/Larry, the show, and today's date. We'll get some links in there for those sites. But apparently, most people using the sites are finding the information that has been leaked is inaccurate. Former home addresses, incorrect dates of birth. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, well, and it depends on, so the other question is, you know, where the sites are getting that data. Was it from that data breach that they had a copy of that information for? If that's the case, you know, having inaccurate information out there, I guess, could be helpful if people are trying to use that information to do identity theft. A lot of different data aggregation companies, so I do recommend, you know, if anyone's ever curious, Google yourself, see what comes up. A lot of those companies will aggregate data in a variety of ways. Some of the information may be outdated. You might end up having the information from somebody else, but it shows up in your name. And that can happen in a variety of ways, depending on how that data is either supplied from external companies or how it might be scraped from other resources that might be available online. So even the information may not just be authoritative records, I would consider, either from the government or the real centralized locations that we think this is really my data. This is true. It's, you know, given by some other authority. It could be supplied from a variety of other locations too. So I think that's the bigger question too, is how are we supplying that identity data? And how truthful is it? How much of that is fact versus somebody supplied inaccurate information and we're using it to make decisions that somebody is who they say they are, or, you know, what kind of history somebody's had?
Yeah. I know the check sites advise people to protect their financial identity by freezing their credit. And that makes it more difficult, I guess, for bad actors to open accounts in your name. What are your thoughts about people freezing their credit?
I highly recommend it. I think that's one of the items that, you know, comes up from this. What should I think about if I was part of this breach? And actually, one of the things I would recommend is, whether you are a part of this breach or not, I do recommend freezing your credit. Also freeze the credit of family members, including children, just to make sure that no one can take out lines of credit or attempt any different types of identity theft. And it helps to secure that at least a little bit more. It has been noted that, you know, you wouldn't anticipate, you have a newborn child, they're not going to be taking out a credit card or, you know, purchasing property or anything like that. But over time, somebody might get some of that information or actually try to take out credit in their name. And then you find out later, when they're, you know, 16, 18, or trying to get credit in their name, that credit already exists because somebody used it. So I highly recommend freeze your credit. Generally, it's going to be at Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. You can do it online. when you create accounts. The nice thing about actually doing that too, outside of just being able to freeze your credit, you do get regular checks or communications from those organizations. So if something does change, you might get a good notification. In addition to any kind of third-party credit monitoring, a lot of banks, credit unions will automatically do a little bit of that for you so you can keep up to date. So it gives you a lot more information. It allows you to freeze your credit so no one else can take credit in your name. So it does help to protect that information. And if you do need to make a purchase, if you need to take out credit, it's relatively easy to thaw that credit. So you can actually open it up for, you know, a day, a few hours, so someone can perform any kind of checks, and then it kind of locks it back up so no one can kind of do that in the future. So it is relatively easy. I've done that with my accounts, and highly recommend others do that as well. And one thing I've noted for people, there's a great guide, and it's IntelTechniques.com. They actually have a workbook. So if you want to freeze your credit or even just try to find ways to remove your information from the internet, they actually have a workbook on how to do that and how you can contact a variety of agencies to do it. I did take that as a personal challenge probably a few years ago to actually go through that entire workbook to try to remove as much information as I could from the internet. It's a lot of work, but if you just do the credit freeze, that's a huge help. The other pieces really do come in when you Google your name and you find information how to try to reduce the results that people kind of get from those searches. Whether it's the accurate information, you know, address, phone number, or inaccurate information, just being able to get some of that off the internet or is easily accessible to others can help out, not just with identity theft or someone taking out credit, but also spam, phishing, junk mail in your physical or virtual mailbox. A lot of those pieces can help out with that, since some of that data would also be used for solicitization purposes or marketing.
Our guest today, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. We're looking at technology today and with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, and also taking other IT questions as well. If you've got some problems, we hope you'll join in, or questions, I hope you'll join in regardless of your question. We're dealing a bit with security, but other questions are welcome as well. When I went on to the NPDbreach.com, it offered me a couple of alternatives for getting in. One was my social security number, which I wasn't going to give, and the other was my phone number, which I did give, and I think probably people would be advised to use their phone number, not their social security number.
Right. Yeah, and I think that brings up another great question too, with any kind of website you're using to look up, you know, am I impacted? Even when I look at the website, I'm like, well, do I want to give my first name, last name, date of birth? And I think maybe email was, or phone number was the other one.
Yep. much of the, I was going to say, and I think we've kind of already talked about it a bit, that a lot of that data, as you said, is available through public records. And so somebody else wondering, could the news reports of this incident be overblown? Jesse LeGrue, our guest, he's kind of frozen, I think, in space. Oh, there he is. He's back. Jesse, what do you think? Jesse LeGrue, our guest today. Jesse, I'm not sure if you're hearing me, but the Identity Theft Resource Center told CNBC that much of that information is already available through public records, as you indicated. Could news reports of this incident be overblown, somebody's asking?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think a lot of people would feel maybe it shouldn't be overblown, because even just having that information seems like a low threshold to many in order to be able to use it. So even if somebody has my data, what processes are we using to make sure that the people supplying it are actually the people that own that data? You know, this is my information. How do you make sure that it's actually me on the other end? Because it really is just data that gets moved around on a consistent basis back and forth. And there are a variety of other ways that people can help to make sure the person is who they say they are. And I think that's really one of the challenges that many have, including the United States, in terms of how we look at some of the data and how we prove identities, that also help to alleviate the threat. I would say if your social security number and other information are easily available, is it a risk? Definitely. The more information people have about you can make it really, really easy to create accounts in your name, to take out credit in your name. And so unfortunately, it's just very easy to do without needing to really validate who you are. Just having the data in itself for many organizations is enough to say, yep, you are who you say you are. You get access to whatever services that you need. So there's, it definitely depends, but I think in our day and age with a lot of the resources available on the internet, people have the right data. It can still be a pretty big risk.
Yeah. Terry in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but I wanted to say that their daughter tried to freeze the credit of her child, but learned it couldn't be done until a child is 14 years old. The caller said it's not impossible, but it is difficult to freeze credit for a child under the age of 14.
Yeah, and the and that can be one of the challenges that we have, is when can you kind of freeze the credit? And I think part of that is, you know, how are we protecting identity information in the long run? And are we doing it from the very beginning? The social security number as an identifier, it really is just a number. In many cases, you don't even need to supply a social security card, which is never recommended to actually be kept on your person. The number itself being supplied as kind of that authoritative identifier is kind of a challenge. And you can create a lot of issues. And minors can't freeze their own credit, and there are only certain ways you can do it when you're going through different credit agencies. So that's kind of a challenge too. And I think by default, a lot of that should actually just be frozen. It should be protected in a way that people don't have to worry about taking that action themselves. But I think there also needs to be ways to catch up our system so that if somebody has my social security number, should they be able to do the vast amount of things that they can do with it just by having that number? And when you think about all the interactions that people have with that data, it exchanges hands in a variety of different ways. Every time you exchange that information is another possible way for that data to get exposed, whether it's making a copy of it to supply to a government agency or a different institution, when that data moves around, there's just more ways for that data to get exposed. And if we assume that data is exposed, how do we make sure our systems help to protect what access that grants, whether it's creating accounts or something else? So I think the way we actually handle that information could be much better.
John emailed to ask for the name of the website, again, with the workbook to delete personal information from the internet.
Yeah, it's IntelTechniques.com, one word. And it's /workbook.html. If you go to the website, they have a variety of resources available. On that workbook site, they give some quick guidance on credit freezes. But if you're really interested in doing a deep dive into your own personal information on the internet, IGRIS gives a great guidance. And that PDF, I think, is regularly updated. I think there's an accompanying book that kind of goes along with it. But I've used that one for years and suggested for anyone who's really interested in trying to remove their information or just to find out where is my information on the internet. So it can be a really good exploratory guide.
So it's IntelTechniques.com?
Correct.
And then you can look for the workbook when you get to there.
They'll have a link. Otherwise, it's /workbook.html. But once you get on the website, it's a pretty common item that people are interested in. So there is a link.
Karen in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I actually have two questions, or one question that is after a statement. The first thing is, I'm just kind of laughing, thinking about when I was going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison back in the day, our college IDs, the number we used was our Social Security number.
Yep.
Somewhere out there, I have a college ID with my Social Security number bouncing around. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But the question I have is, and you may have already answered something like this, but I've started to use a service called Eno, I think that's it, for when I charge something online, and it generates a new charge account number every time I make a transaction that goes back to my actual account. Have you spoken a little bit about that, and do you think those things are useful?
We haven't yet. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, and there are a lot of different resources out there that will basically do the same thing. It will generate a credit card number, basically, that's for one use only. So you go in, you supply your information, your request for it to create a new credit card. You use it for whatever subscription you might want at that time or whatever purchase, and then it kind of goes away after that. Or you can continue to use it for a certain period of time. And a lot of different banking applications also offer similar options. So those have been really good solutions to get around that one number that might exist for years that people can gather and then actually use. Could also be available for one use only. And I think the Apple credit card also allows basically the same thing. So it gives you a virtual number for each purchase to make sure that it can't be reused. If somebody gets it, it was only available for that one transaction, so they can't use it again. That's also the idea behind Tap and Pay. So if you're using your card at a physical retailer and you're using Tap and Pay, you're giving not your credit card information, but a token that's generated each time. So even if somebody was able to get the information, they shouldn't be able to reuse it. It's only available for that one transaction, which is great. So I think that the more those kind of technologies work, you're kind of protecting that back end data and supplying that unique identifier token, credit card number, whatever it might be. And even if it gets stolen, it can't be used because it was only able to be used at one time.
Yeah. Yeah. Karen, good idea. Thank you very much for calling. Just to go along with that, Gina in Packwaukee emailed to say their company's email was recently hacked and additional security measures were put in place, but they failed. And because of this, Gina purchased LifeLock. She's wondering, Gina's wondering, what are your thoughts on LifeLock, and is it worth the expense?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think a lot of solutions help to identify when something goes wrong with your information, or they'll offer additional services to actually perform some of these tasks for you as well. So we talked about credit freezing. So you might have to manually contact Experian, TransUnion, or Equifax to freeze your credit. Some of the services might actually, they might help you perform those duties on your behalf. I don't know if LifeLock does that for you itself, or if it's really just for notification should something go wrong. But some of those services can help you. But a lot of the features that are available tend to be freely available either through the credit agencies or from your bank. But having some of those notifications can be helpful. I currently am not using a third party tool to do that. I'm actually using the credit monitoring I get from my bank and the reports I get from the three credit agencies, because I created an account as soon as I freeze my credit, which gives me another way to keep an eye on that. And you know, that's really free. Some of the other options they have is dark web monitoring, or maybe even some technical options if you wanted to use a VPN or a different secure browser. A lot of those are also available for free depending on where you're looking. The dark web monitoring might actually come with a variety of banking services as well. So there might be free ways to do it, but if you can get it in one place, if it's working for you, if you're getting the information you want, that can save a lot of time. But each service might work a little bit differently. And there are some ways to get at least a majority of that for free.
Pauline emailed to, you mentioned the three services. Pauline wonders, how safe is it to log into one of the reporting agencies? Equifax itself was hacked several years ago. And Pauline wonders if you recommend Pauline going back to the site and putting in the personal information again.
Right. So it is one of those questions of, well, who do I trust? Because even the credit agencies might get breached. I created my accounts at least to try to keep a better eye on what I could. In the end, if they're going to get breached, whether I use their online service or not, they have my data anyway. So I decided to sign up. One of the items that I did notice from one of the services, so, and we tell this to everyone, so when you log into any kind of website, you want to protect your login, right? Protect your password, use something unique, turn on multi-factor authentication when you can. A lot of banks do that automatically or they require it. I did notice when I did sign up, at least for one of them, one of the three credit bureaus, is they didn't actually require or even have available multi-factor authentication, which I found interesting. And so I think a lot of organizations are still kind of still increasing what they can do to protect information. I would say the less you can supply data that could be used in any kind of malicious or bad way, the less you can share that information, the better. You may need to share it to get access to specific services, but the less you share that information, generally, it gives less opportunities for that data to get lost or to get stolen. But if you are talking about one of the three credit agencies, I think you're generally going to have to supply some information to get access to your own account so you can perform that credit freeze, whether it's over the phone or whether it's online.
Yeah, it always, you know, when you look at that personal information and you wonder, oh boy, do I really want to give that information? But it's the only way you can, you know, get service is to give that information.
Yeah, and for the three credit agencies, I believe all of them did have a phone option. So, you know, there's different risks depending on how you communicate information. If you and a person are standing in a room where no one else is around and you're having a conversation, generally that's going to be pretty secure, right? There's ideally nothing recording it or posting it on the internet. But as soon as you start putting it on a website, or just via a phone call, the ways to pick up that data, to steal it, to send it somewhere else, they change. So I would kind of consider that a little bit as well. Maybe using one of the phone prompts, which are still electronic, might give you a little bit higher confidence that the data wouldn't be stolen, but it still has to be used in some way. And you're never quite sure what those backend systems look like, how that data is moving around, either internally on their networks or over the internet. So it's hard to know.
Hard to know. Kevin in Oregon, we'll go to you. Hi, Kevin.
Yes, hi. I've been notified in the last year by 3 or 4 data breaches. And in each case, they offer a year or two of credit monitoring with, in this case, Experian. And what I've run into is now they will not allow you to put those monitoring services on a single account. So now I have 4 monitoring accounts, and they each want a separate email. Are those worthwhile? Should I cancel the first ones and just keep the latest ones? What do you suggest with those monitoring services and keeping the accounts sort of organized?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question, especially considering as you've had, many people are a part of some kind of data breach more than once a year. And so you get these offers pretty regularly. Normally, I would just keep one active at any one time. I don't think there's going to be a significant benefit to having multiple accounts running at the same time. If anything, what I would do is I'd probably keep track of the, because it's usually a code. It does expire when I've seen those every so often. Keep track of the discount codes that you have. I would actually try to renew one when the other one expires. So let's say it started today, it expires in a year. Maybe you can use one of the other codes to extend it a year after that. I would not sign up for multiple accounts. It's just a little bit too hard to keep track of. And then you're just sharing a little bit more data. So I would try to just keep one of those active. You're going to get a little bit of information, but if you already have an Experian account that's tied to kind of your credit history, you're going to get some benefit just from that without the additional subscription as well. So just having the account can be helpful, even if you don't have the additional benefits for the paid subscription.
Kevin, thank you for calling. Let's go to Joe in Jefferson next. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I want to give some advice to people hearing all this that are probably freaking out. Your guest is doing a great job, but I recently signed up for all 3 freezes. It's so easy, nothing to be scared of. In general, one tip I like to tell people: when you go to a website, if you type in the URL directly, it will sometimes give you a suggestion as you're typing, and then you'll see a little globe, and you know that might be, just click it. But that can be tricky. I let the Google results let that page load, and then pick from that one. So, for instance, going to TransUnion.com or Equifax.com or Experian.com, I did that all 3 times. I checked all the various, because they usually pay for the top results that's sponsored. I usually don't reward that and click that. I just go scroll down. Usually it's duplicated, so I click. And then once it loads, I make sure that's the real site, because in this case, you want to make sure you're at the right site. Because I believe all 3 asked for your social. You would think they would have to, but I could have sworn one only asked for the last 4. So maybe they have other ways to know who you are when they ask you. But so it was painless. You do it, and Experian gives you there's no way around this. I'm very thorough when I check stuff like this. And Experian, for people to know, when you sign up to make the free account, because all 3, you have to make an account, a username and password, like your guest said. And there might be going forward, 2-step verification, which I can't remember, but that's after the fact. You make your account, right? You create your username and password, and then Experian forces you to take a free basic thing that you're enrolling in. You're enrolling in a free credit monitoring service from Experian that's free. And then afterwards, you get some emails. So look around and make sure you uncheck if you don't want to receive emails. But Equifax, I find, had the most. I also, browse these websites. That's another tip. Browse the site first before you log in or create an account to make sure you're at the right site. and you'll know. If it was some bogus site that's going to get you scammed or something or steal your data, it probably wouldn't be as thorough and have all the different options. So that's a good tip. And then the last thing is Equifax, I've been using for years. It's about $125 a year for their plan, for their credit monitoring. And there's two different things. It's tricky. There's credit monitoring, and then there's ID theft protection. So they some service, one of those three offers both, and it's confusing. But Equifax, I recommend that, even though they were hacked, I figure if you were hacked, you're going to learn your lesson. So I'm confident with Equifax. Use them for $125 a year for their service, and they have several plans, unlike the other two sites.
All right, Joe, thank you so much. Comment, Jesse?
Yeah, I think the feedback, too, of making sure the website that you're going to is legitimate is a good one. And it's usually something we recommend. So even if you get an email, let's say it was from somebody to say, hey, click here to sign up for, freezing your credit or for additional credit monitoring, you know, it's hard to know whether that link itself is valid or whether the website is valid. So typing in what that website is manually and knowing, you know, this is, for example, Experian.com or a different website, you know where you're going to, and being able to navigate the website will give you an idea of how legitimate in theory it should be. That's really, really good advice, because phishing emails and bad links, even as we've seen sponsored links from Google, have been misused. So people will basically pay for bad ads where people will click on something that seems good because it's, you know, it's a sponsored ad, but it turns out somebody is sponsoring a link that they want you to go to and supply information that they're going to steal and use in a bad way. So even some of those ad sites can be challenging. So validating that website is extremely important.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today. Questions for him. We've been talking security a lot, but we'll take other IT questions as well as we visit with Jesse. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up later in our last segment of the program, UW Band Director Mike LaCrone joins us to talk about his new memoir. It's titled Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story. So that's our second segment for the show today. But right now, we're talking with Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. We're talking about security, but we are taking other questions as well relating to IT, and you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Let's take another call. Meredith in Greenwood, you're on board here. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, within the last 2 weeks, I received an email that said that my Social Security number was found on the dark web. And I can't remember who it came from. It looked kind of legitimate. I didn't do anything with it. They did include the last four of my Social Security number, but I'm always hesitant to answer these emails because I don't know if it could be more harmful than just letting it ride. But it didn't come to my junk email. It came to my primary, and I have a good filter. I don't get junk stuff in my primary box. So I just wondered about that.
Yeah.
And there's and so I'd say first, whether it was legitimate or not, I think one of the best things, at least to protect what can be impacted by that information getting out, is once again freezing credit. I think that will help just to make sure no one can take out credit in your name, or it will at least limit some of the risk or reduce some of the risk for identity theft. In addition, you know, always keep an eye on bank accounts or anything for suspicious activity that you might not be that you might not have performed yourself. So whether it's a purchase or something. for a lot of the notifications that we get, what they call the dark web monitoring, that actually comes with a variety of services these days. So it could be a legitimate offering for some service that you already have. And so sometimes it's hard to know. That could be from your bank. It could actually be from even insurance. So I've actually seen even for homeowners insurance, they will have some kind of cyber liability insurance, which I found actually really, really interesting. So you might be getting legitimate communications from a service that just has that monitoring as a benefit. So it very much could be legitimate. I think understanding at least where that came from would be helpful. I have seen it in password managers as well. But it might be, a legitimate thing that you're receiving. I would just recommend do the at least the normal steps that we'd consider for protecting your identity, freezing your credit and looking out for unusual transactions.
Yeah, good points. I was thinking about my own situation where my online tax company where I do the tax prep has Identify, I think it is, that does that service just as part of the, me doing business with them.
Correct. Yep. And if right now, I think even for the three different credit bureaus, when you go on their site, they'll have some offerings for free, some they'll have paid. But it's very likely when you sign up for a lot of different services, you might actually have those built in without even thinking about it.
Yep. Meredith, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Johnny and Monona will go to you next. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I recently have a Samsung cell phone for work, and it required a microphone upgrade. And as we know, most people just click and accept and things. And I said, well, let me look at the fine print. And when I did, among other things, it said Samsung had the right to record my voice at any time from the microphone and store it on a foreign server for up to 2 years. So my question is, what type of security does breach for me personally does that have? And particularly with all the AI that's going on nowadays, so really all they would need is a picture of me, they've got my voice, and why would Samsung want to do something like that?
Yes, good question.
Yeah, it is a good question, and I think that's nice work taking a look at the fine print. I think that's one of the things that's the most challenging because we get prompts on our phones or devices constantly to accept something. So keeping an eye on that is always a good idea. Part of it is for a lot of the end user license agreements or terms of service. A lot of apps now do need to notify you or they do need you to accept certain terms so they can even use specific features on the phone. So I have a Samsung device. I think Bixby comes built in that may require certain approvals to be able to listen to audio, to be able to respond or to look information up for you. So part of it could just be legitimate use of the service, and either they could ask you every time you want to use it or they ask you once. And so that could be at least one of the reasons they're asking you up front. The challenge is, well, if I do accept, what else could they be doing with that data? Could they be using it in ways that otherwise I wouldn't want them to use it? I think that's the question that's good to ask ourselves for any specific application that we use. Generally, I will decline unless I know it really is necessary for the things that I use the device for on a day-to-day basis. If I'm not sure, I might just hit decline and wait for that time I try to use a feature and it says, hey, this doesn't work unless you accept this. And then, I have a new decision to make. Do I actually want to use that feature, considering there could be a risk if it does, is used at other times where I might not be aware of it. We can't all read all of those different terms of service all the time. And I think that's the other challenging piece of it. So I guess the short story is it could be legitimate based upon the different services they want you to be able to use your phone for. If you don't think you want it, I would say decline it. And then you will usually find out as soon as an application needs to use what that approval was there for. And it will say, hey, by the way, I can't do this unless you allow this. And then you can kind of make a decision from there. So it could be legitimate, but they try to make a lot of organizations will try to make blanket statements because they don't want you to be prompted every single time you want to use a feature because it can be a little bit annoying, but it does create that situation where you kind of get used to just hitting accept on all of those pieces. So decline it, see what happens, and then you can kind of go from there.
All right, Johnny, thank you. Karen in Madison, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to know, I'm 70, over 70, so, and I grew up learning, you know, from my mother, you always get rid of your, it's over the top, but, you know, like when the mail comes and your name is on there and your address, and I'm always wanting to just, I'm scared to throw anything away without shredding it or, you know, because I know there's always going to be low tech, but is that over the top? Because it really interferes with my life at the point where you've got a pile of old mail that you're afraid to just get rid of. Can people really, you know, I mean, anybody can look in the telephone book and find that, but that's what I wanted to know, and I think a lot of people laugh at me, but I don't, is it, a lot of people also do worry about it, so.
All right, Karen, thank you for calling. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, I think it's, I honestly do the same thing. So for any mail, I tend not to just put it in the recycling. I do try to shred it just because dumpster diving, which is people trying to get into, you know, bins where people will throw away sensitive information without protecting it in some way, whether it's shredding or even trying to write over it with marker. People still get that information and they use it for a variety of ways. So I do recommend disposing of that information securely because it can give information about memberships you have, your information in terms of your address or location, and it might have other information that you don't want out there. Are there other ways to get it? Probably. But a lot of it is just lessening the ways people can get that information. And so for me, I would still recommend, secure of information that has your personal data in a secure way. And that could include shredding it or taking it to a facility that will do it in bulk for you. And a lot of places will do that. Take in a trash bag, they'll securely get rid of it for you. That way, if you don't have a shredder or another way to do it, you can just do that, you know, once a month, a couple times a year, and then it's out of sight, out of mind.
Karen, thanks. Mary, who's road tripping through Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I was calling because I work at a venue, and we have a lot of people that come through that have what they think are legitimate tickets to the event, but they're not. And they basically Googled, like, a concert name, you know, whoever's coming to town, they put that artist in, and it comes up with the venue. But it might even have the venue name in the URL, but it is not our venue. And I just want to get awareness out so that people know. And I mean, I don't know how to tell people even where to click to avoid that kind of thing happening. So I don't know if you could talk about that.
We can talk about that, and we will talk about that, Mary. But at the moment, we are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we're going to be back with our guests today. Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're continuing our tech update with Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And, you know, we can take a look at strengthening passwords or turning on multi-factor authentication, maybe updating software to keep yourself safe online. You may have some questions about safety, but you may also have some other IT questions, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Jesse, as we broke for news, we had Mary road tripping through Wisconsin. She's actually still with us online, but she works for a company that sells event tickets, and there are many third-party sales sites, and Mary says that you need to be careful that you're getting a legitimate sales site and not a scammer.
Yeah, it's so counterfeit just about anything is kind of an issue, whether it's an ID, like a driver's license, or if it's a ticket for an event. A lot of, and if you actually look online, you can find a variety of different sources that will offer up templates for tickets that you can easily create your own. They'll create them for you. They'll even potentially print them and mail them to you as well to make sure you have high quality paper that would actually replicate the real ticket. A lot of those sites tend to sell them for more, not to try to create fake tickets, but they'll be labeled as for, you know, entertainment purposes, whether it's for a personal party or something else. But if you do look at the tickets, they actually do appear pretty legitimate. They look like real tickets. The best thing to do with any of those tickets is to try to validate it. So if you're going to a website and the prices really do seem too good to be true, they might be. Same thing with when we look at phishing emails. If you're getting offers for something that looks too good to be true, it's probably a good idea to think twice before replying to that email or before clicking on the link. That can also be the same thing with purchasing a ticket online. If the prices do appear too good to be true and they're not that authoritative source, usually when you're purchasing tickets, they're going to have a list of places to purchase them from. If it's not on that list, I would, you know, question myself, should I be buying from the seller? Does this look too good to be true? And how can I validate that the ticket's legitimate if and when I buy it? And I think that's another important part, because you may purchase the ticket, it may look legitimate, but you might find out it's actually fake. It's not for that real venue, or somebody who's trying to really, you know, sell fake tickets.
Yeah. I remember, you know, Mike LaCrone's going to be with us in just a brief time. And I can remember the Rose Bowl, the first Rose Bowl back in 94, when so many people were hoodwinked into buying tickets online. And then they get there and there's no, they can't get in because the tickets were fake. And so they wound up not being able to get in to watch the game.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. I think the biggest item, if you're not sure of the source, find ways to just validate the ticket that you received is legitimate. But the best guidance is to purchase from the locations that are listed as the authorized sellers for those venues, to make sure that you're at least getting that information from a valid source. Any individual can be questionable, and any larger third-party sites that say they sell tickets en masse but aren't on that vendor list to sell tickets are probably locations to stay away from.
Yeah, I was thinking about the University of Wisconsin for athletic events. There's an app, a Badger app, and So you can go to that app, and if you have tickets, you can sell them on the app, or you can purchase on the app, and you know you're going to get what you're paying for, or if you're selling, you're going to get the money.
Yeah.
Makes good sense. Linda in Fond du Lac called to ask if you could recommend getting a VPN, or if you would recommend getting a VPN, and from where before going on a trip.
Yeah, and I would
And VPN, by the way, is virtual private network.
Yep. Yeah, and so the virtual private network, or VPN, will help you get basically an internet connection that at least people on your same local network, whether it's like hotel Wi-Fi, they can't see. So the idea is to try to keep your information and your traffic private, even from the location that might be hosting the internet. So any internet provider that you have generally has pretty good access to your network traffic. Having a VPN can help make that a little bit more private. Do I recommend it? Yes, especially if you are traveling, if you're using unknown networks. Sometimes you actually go to a hotel and you find out there's a variety of hotel networks. Maybe not all of them are actually for that hotel. They might actually be people putting up wireless networks that are theirs because they want to collect your data. Having a VPN can help to limit the risk for that. There's other benefits that people try to use the virtual private networks for, including for viewing content. But I do recommend it. There are a lot of them out there that you can use that are completely free if you have very limited use cases. Normally, a lot of the paid services, when you do start paying for it, generally you're going to get more, you're going to get better service or better speed, or a little bit of both. They may also have add-on services that you can take advantage of, such as password managers, or like we talked about before, dark web monitoring. They might actually have services for that as well. ExpressVPN has been a VPN that a lot of people do use. They have free offerings. A lot of VPNs also have deals for specific periods of time, whether it's for a few months or for a year. So you can take advantage of some of those as well. I do pay for my own VPN just because I wanted a little bit better speed, and I wanted to use my VPN on multiple devices at the same time. So if you do have multiple devices, that could also be maybe a reason you might need to pay versus use a free one. If you are using any kind of free service, make sure you know it's legitimate, that it is one that's supported by reviews and that other people are commenting in terms of the quality. Generally, any free service, they're either trying to sell you something or they're finding another way to make revenue. Usually, you're going to have a better idea that your information is better protected and that you're using more legitimate services if you're paying for it. But a lot of those providers will have free plans and paid plans, just depending on your use case. So definitely recommend it, especially for travel. The big question is, what kind of devices do you have? How many devices? Most virtual private network providers will support a variety of devices, and you can get them up and running pretty quickly.
And you mentioned ExpressVPN is one that's commonly used, but there are others.
Yeah, ExpressVPN has been commonly used. I've seen it often with, especially with free offerings. NordVPN is another one. You'll actually frequently see ads for a variety of them online. I've used ProtonVPN in the past and currently enjoy that. But everyone has kind of their own use case. Depending on the speed that you need, that might tell you you need a specific provider. If you're doing just basic web browsing and you just want to make sure your internet's more protected, most of the free services out there will likely give you some good value. And even if you just Google free VPN providers, you will get some valid results from different organizations. You might actually see them from like CNET is a common provider of suggestions for products. And they'll give usually a breakdown of the various products and which ones you can use. But you can find a lot of good options for free, especially if you just need web browsing.
Mark in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hey, I just, Larry, just had a dovetail question on that VPN issue. While traveling, is using your cell service hotspot just as secure as using a VPN? I'm assuming most, you know, reputable cell providers have, excellent security attached to them.
Yeah, using your phone as a hotspot is another great option outside of using a VPN. You can have all of your other devices connect using your cell phone, and you're basically on your cellular network, which limits some of the risk. There are some odd times when if somebody's able to take over a cellular network, which people have done in the past to try to impersonate or pretend that they're a cell phone tower. There's ways people can use that to try to look at your traffic. Using that and a VPN is even better, but it might slow down the communication. So I do think the hotspot's another good option. A lot of plans actually include that as a base offering that was more common to be something you need to pay extra for. So that would be an item, you know, check your cell phone provider, see what they have for that option. Still using a virtual private network on top of that could still be even more protection if you want to be extra paranoid. But it is probably going to be, it's going to give a little bit more trust than a random network you're going to have that's freely available or unsecured in any location that you go to.
Robert in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, I was just wondering, with motor vehicles rolling off the assembly line in today's society being essentially computers on wheels, I was just wondering if there's a VPN or some way I can protect my identity. I do DoorDash 8 a.m. to midnight. I'm all over the place. I need a reliable internet connection. What can I do if I decide to buy a 2025 Chevy Equinox hybrid? What can I do to protect my identity if my phone is connected to the computer in my dashboard in my vehicle?
That's a really great question. So there's probably a couple things that even thinking about with smart vehicles or just, vehicles that might be more connected to the internet. A lot of vehicles might actually be using cellular service to communicate location. They might also offer internet accessibility. When you do plug in a device into any of those vehicles, it could be using internet sharing rather than just powering the device. If you're concerned with how your cell phone is connected to the internet, and let's say you don't trust whatever internet's being supplied by your vehicle, one thing I'd recommend is to actually look at your sharing settings for your device. In many cases, you can use it what they call like charge only mode, so it doesn't share other features or share data between the vehicle and the cell phone. That might be limited depending on whether it's sharing just data for, let's say, maps, which is very common to have a dashboard on your vehicle, which might show up the maps application that you have on your phone, or whether it's the general internet. So that would be one suggestion, is to just limit what you're sharing with your device and your vehicle. In terms of the actual vehicle's internet connection or what data is being collected, I don't have a very quick answer for that, unfortunately, just because every vehicle might be a little bit different. Whenever you plug in a device into anything, I generally recommend being cautious. So if you're at let's say you're at an airport and you plug into a random charger, do you know what happens between, you know, the wall plate or the table that you're plugging your device into and whatever source is available? Could that be trying to get information from your device? Is it being used for more than charging the device? So making sure to only use trusted items to plug your device into and limiting the options for sharing from your device would be my primary recommendations. Outside of that, the big question is, if you were concerned, can you disable some of those features in your vehicle? That may or may not be a possibility, but it is something I would recommend whenever purchasing a vehicle. Have a good understanding. How is internet supplied? How can I limit that sharing? And many times the dealerships will actually have had that question before and can give even better advice.
Let's go to Chris in Green Bay next. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have had some of my information breached, and you get a letter in the mail, and they tell you, you know, you have these services available. So I have OnAlert. OnAlert notified me that my Social Security number was found on the dark web. So I went ahead and froze my, and I have had my credit froze on some of the sites, but I've done it with all three credit companies. And so I'm wondering if there's something more, and the concern about that message from OnAlert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. What I generally recommend, so freezing the credit is a great first step. The other items I recommend, keep an eye on communications that you're getting, whether it's in the mail or via email. So if somebody is signing up for services, sometimes you might actually get mailings for those services that could be a little bit more unusual. It gives you at least another way of knowing potentially whether someone's trying to use your data. Also, I would just keep an eye on bank accounts or and looking for suspicious activity. So do you see charges that you're not sure you made? And how can you get alerting for those different things? That can be also something you can set up with your bank. A lot of banks will have a variety of alerting mechanisms depending on what you want to know about, whether it's spending a certain amount of money, having a certain deposit, paying a specific vendor. And so I would look for those options to see how you can get better notified. But freezing your credit is going to be one of the best ways to at least protect against someone taking out credit in your name and at least impersonating you for that reason. Usually, a lot of the identity theft is financially motivated. And so they either want to take credit out in your name or impersonate you for some other reason. So I think those credit fees are important because a lot of times they'll do a credit check. People can't do a credit check when that's frozen in that way. And so usually that'll throw a flag for those other organizations. So keep an eye on your bank statements too. I think that'll help. And just look out for any unusual communications that could indicate somebody's trying to use your data. But you'll likely continue to get notifications from the three credit agencies as well, as long as you have those online accounts. So just check your notifications options for those providers, because they'll usually help to send you out some information as well if they see anything suspicious.
Yeah. Mary had a similar question. Equifax informed Mary that her phone number had been found on the internet with her name, her husband's name, but also Mary's late mother and father-in-law's name. She wonders if she should care.
Yeah, I would. Sometimes it can be just outdated information. I would really look at, you know, is this something that was performed on my behalf, or do we think this could be someone trying to get credit or something else in somebody else's name, or is it potentially just junk email? Once again, I always recommend for everyone, freeze your credit. So it helps to take one of those steps that I think we think is reactionary, and it makes it a little bit more preventative. I would do that regardless. If you don't think you need to take any action with the mail, if you didn't request it, generally I would just dispose of it and keep an eye on my accounts like I normally would.
And by the way, freezing credit does not mean that you can still continue to use your credit card and so forth.
Correct. Yep. You can still use your credit cards, all the other accounts that you have continue to function. Usually what it means is if you want to create a new account that requires a credit check, you might need to thaw your credit in order to do that check. And so let's say if you are purchasing a vehicle, they'll usually do a credit check just to make sure everything looks good on their end for a loan or anything else they need to do. If you ask which agency are you going to be checking my credit, and let's say they say, well, it's Experian, usually at that point, and I checked my own account, I have a link on the bottom, thaw my credit. And I can just click the button, it thaws it for a certain period of time, they can do their check, and then it either automatically closes it up, or I can click another button and freeze that credit again. So even though it does give you some limits for new credit, it's actually really easy to thaw that credit, so you can still perform those checks and then freeze it again.
Veronica would like to know if cell phone signal enhancers work and if they're worth the money.
Yeah, they can. So in a lot of the cellular extenders, so for example, if you're in an apartment building or any kind of building that just has a lot of interference, maybe a lot of metal on the exterior of the building, but basically enough metal between you and a cellular tower that it creates trouble for communicating. If you have an extender that's near a window or an area that gets better signal, it can allow you to get a better signal inside of your home, apartment, whatever location you're in, because you can kind of place that device in a place where you have good signal, and then it can help to extend that inside the rest of that environment. So you'll have better signal inside. So your device will basically be getting its main signal from that device you're installing, which is getting that signal from the cellular tower. So they can be helpful. It just depends if you can put that device in a good place. If you don't have a good place to put that device, or if you don't have any location in your area that does get a good signal, you might have limited options. So in the end, you still need to have a place that you can place that extender that is going to have a good signal. If you can't do that, it's not going to be able to do much for you.
Okay. Well, on that happy note, Jesse, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. Again, I always look forward to your visits, and we'll look forward to your next one. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he assesses implementation strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data. And he'll be back, and we will talk with him again probably in a couple of months. Looking forward to that. And looking forward to our next guest, who has a new book out. And we're going to talk with Mike Leckrone from the UW Band. I'm Larry Mueller. On Wisconsin, right? Great to have Mike Leckrone with us. Mike always loved a big entrance, and the director of the UW-Madison Marching Band for 50 years was known for arriving at varsity band concerts at the Kohl Center, suspended from the air, and he talks about that, among many other things, in his brand new memoir. It's titled Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story. The book's officially released tomorrow when he and his co-author Doug Moe appear together at 6 p.m. At the Madison Central Library. But we're getting a preview because he's with us again in the with me in the studio to talk about the book and about his life. And I hope you'll join the conversation. Have you enjoyed a fifth quarter celebration at a Badger football game? Were you a member of the UW Marching Band? Do you recognize moments of happiness as they are happening to you. I know Mike hopes that. Well, I do too, for that matter. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mike Lecrone, welcome back.
Oh, it's always good to see you, Larry.
Oh, man, it's good to see you. And I really enjoyed reading your book. It's packed full of things I never knew.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I didn't reveal all the secrets, but I'm glad to hear there are things you didn't know about.
Oh, man, it's such a fun read. Maybe talk first, and you describe this in the book, but why did you title the book Moments of Happiness?
Well, it came from an experience I had that I was giving a talk at the Rose Bowl, the first one we went, and it so struck me that this was a moment in these kids' life that they needed to remember, and so I made the statement. I said, this is going to be a moment of happiness that you need to remember forever, and it'll help you get through some of those moments of unhappiness that will undoubtedly occur. And it sort of stuck. Some of the kids in the band picked up on it. That, you know, they'll say, well, that was a moment of happiness. And once it got in my mind and in their minds, I thought, this is too good a title to pass up.
Yeah, I would agree. And you wrote this with Doug Moe. And Doug's an old friend of mine. So he's a darn good writer.
Nobody better, as far as I'm concerned. He's really good.
I thought he really did a good job of capturing your voice.
Oh, well, I've had other people say that. I think that's great because that's what we wanted to do. I know many times we talked about how would I say it, and he did an awful lot of transcribing. I've got tons and tons of tape recordings that he. Listen to probably more than I did.
Well, one of the things I really liked about the book was there were a lot of stories about your childhood in Indiana and your dad, Harold Lecrone, also your high school band teacher, and what I found a lot of fun to hear about or read about was your performances way back when you started performing with your dad.
Yeah, we called it a vaudeville act. I probably just because it was a convenient title, but it started out because dad was a music teacher and he was always getting calls to do programs. And finally one day he said, well, let's just do it together. I won't have to find anybody else. And so we developed about a 45-minute show that had a lot of novelty things in it. He played multiple instruments. He was a great piano player. And then he had me do some novelty things. And it was great fun. And it taught me a lot about how to deal with an audience. Taught me a lot to how audiences got to react to certain things. Because you probably know that the audiences react very differently. You can do exactly the same thing, and they'll completely be different in the way that they react to it.
Yeah, and you were a great trumpet player right from a young, really young age.
I played in the high school band when I was in the sixth grade, and that was because Dad, I think, could see me getting bored with some of the normal grade school music. And he put me in the group, and I played continually for years, right up until about 20 years ago, I was still playing. But it's something that I love doing, and I hope it came across with that and everybody else.
Oh, I was amazed at some of the things you guys did together. And you went on, you studied at Butler University at Indianapolis, and here is something else I was kind of struck by. You wrote arrangements for the Butler Band while you were a student there.
That's right. They didn't have a regular arranger, so they were using a lot of different students to do it, music students, and I really can't recall whether I volunteered or was drafted. I don't remember which it was, but I probably volunteered because it's a tough job to write those recordings or write those records. And But I got started on it, and then it just kept growing. So I not only was an undergraduate at Butler, but I went on to be a graduate student and then ultimately a faculty member, basically doing the same thing, writing arrangements and conducting a band.
And doing a lot of work on the side, too. You do all these side jobs.
Well, I got married very young.
Teenagers.
Yeah, well, we were that's right. We were teenagers. We had been, quote, going steady since we were in the seventh grade, and we decided to get married very early, and so consequently, I had to make a living. We had some kids. I had a daughter very young, and so we made do, and it was fun. You look back on times like that, as you know, and you say, how did we ever manage to get through it? But looking back on it was fun.
Yeah, it had to have been. Tell us the story, Robert Reynolds, and I think was impactful here in your arrival and getting to Wisconsin.
Bob was the director of bands here when I came. He had succeeded Ray Dvorak, who was a legend as far as I'm concerned, a great, great guy. And Bob Reynolds, and he was looking for an assistant to do the marching band. And he called me one day, and we did meet for a short period of time when he was the director. And he said, well, you know, I'm not going to make a decision till I end the job a little bit longer. And I thought that was the kiss of death. I thought, he said, well, we don't think you're the one for the job. But then later he called me, and I did an interview, and he asked me the same day. He said, if we're going to offer you the job, would you accept it? And it took me about 30 seconds to say, maybe less than that, to say yes. It was a realization of a dream, actually, to be a Big Ten band director.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. A funny incident, and you may have told me, as mentioned this on the air before, but I thought your first visit with your wife.
Oh yeah, well, first visit with Phyllis, we went down State Street at a time when the riots were still going on and all the things that was happening, and I took her to see State Street, and this was going to be her new home, and on driving home after the visit, I said, well, Phyllis, what do you think? And she burst into tears and didn't stop crying for about another half hour.
Oh, man. Well, what was it like when you first got here? You know, what was the, you know, how'd you establish that, your presence with the band?
Well, it was a tough time because in those days, Wisconsin did not have a football team that was worth talking about too much. So Elroy Hirsch came in, and he sort of revitalized the spirit of the band. And fortunately, I came in the same year that Elroy came in. So I was able to sort of play on that spirit. And the big thing was getting people to come out for the band. The band had shrunk. The 3 years that I had not been there, it got down to about 90-some players, which is very small for a Big Ten band.
Yeah.
And our biggest problem was to get people enthusiastic about it and follow the sort of the spirit that Elroy had. And we started by trying to build up the numbers, and then a couple things happened that really worked well. The losing streak was finally over. and that happened during Elroy's time here, and once it was broken, then it seemed like things just fell into place, and there was a little more interest. The band itself wasn't used to working as hard at that point as I expected, and they were making odds on how long I would last because I was pretty demanding on what they were doing at that time.
Well, and you were always pretty demanding. I mean, throughout your career, but. I mean, they came to know what to expect.
They did, yeah. And like most times, once you get experience it, you enjoy it. You enjoy the idea of working this hard and producing results. And once that sort of gets established, then there's no turning back. And we just kept slowly, you know, chipping away at things that we thought we needed to do better. And the kids bought into it, which is very good for me.
We get an email. Somebody wondering what to talk about that run in for a game.
Well, the when I came, they called it the run on, and it originally was a run on. The band would get in the tunnel and run out, and there wasn't a lot of I guess you'd say discipline to it. There wasn't a lot of regularity to it, regulation. And so the first thing I did is I wanted to establish a pattern where when you see the band, you start to build anticipation. And I tried a couple things that didn't work and finally settled on what audiences still see today. I'm very proud of the fact
yeah.
that the run-on has stayed the same, but I wanted to see the tubas come out as sort of building a prelude to what happened. And the drums come out, sort of build anticipation. And then we brought the band out at full step. Now, the difference was when I took over the run-on, they had to stay in step. They had to hit the ground together. They had to stay in line. And all those things that wasn't true in just the run-on that they were doing before. So it got more disciplined. But when you do that, it makes it harder.
Yeah, it does indeed. Mike LaCrone, our guest today. Mike's book is titled Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story. It's great to have him with us. Questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for WPR News, and great to have Mike LaCrone with us as well. Mike LaCrone served as the director of the band, the UW Marching Band, for 50 years before he retired in 2019. And he's co-author of this memoir titled Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story, published this week by the University of Wisconsin Press. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You know, women were first allowed to join the UW Marching Band, I think it was it 74 or 75?
1974.
Yeah, what role did you play in ending the gender barrier?
Well, I'm very proud to say that I was one of the first, if not the first Big Ten band director to say, we need to open this to women. And the odd thing about it is we were the last Big Ten band to add women to the band, because once I opened it to it, the challenge of breaking that barrier, barrier of being able to be the first ones. There were lawsuits that would happen at different other Big Ten bands. And at that point, I was smart enough, one of the few times I've been smart enough, to say, you know, well, it's going to happen eventually anyhow, so we might as well take out the restriction. Once we took it out, the glamour of trying to be the first was lost. And so it took two women in 1974, Paula Schultz was her name and Marianne Thurber. They broke that barrier. And I couldn't have handpicked two people that were better to do
yeah.
it. They were just the right temperament, the right attitude. The men in the band saw it, and they saw that they were not in it for any self-glorification. They just wanted to be a part of the band, and they were just perfect for what happened.
Yeah, and I don't know what the percentage is between men and women in the band, but a lot of women in the band.
Well, one of the things that I've learned to say is when people ask me what the percentage was, my stock answer is, well, I don't know, because it doesn't matter.
And
that's really true. It doesn't matter what the percentage is. And it's interesting to watch after all the years how women have taken over leadership roles, which at the beginning they just wanted to be a part of it. Now they're in some of those leadership roles, being drum majors, being head of the ranks and so forth. So that's been fun to watch happen.
Bill in Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Mike, I remember the band standard during the basketball season in the early 70s was to play Three Blind Mice, and then all of a sudden never heard it again. I wonder if Mike could comment on that. Thanks.
Well, that was an accident. It happened during a game against Minnesota, and I'll say this without any fear of repercussions. The refereeing was terrible. And the band started playing Three Blind Mice because of the reaction. And John Paulus, who was the coach at that point, stood up on the bench, started conducting the rest of the band. And the referees, I think, were a little chagrined. But the funny thing was there was no technical foul. There was no other repercussions. But the fact that it sort of disappeared, I think, wasn't really a fight. And nobody said, don't play it anymore, Mike. But I think it just sort of died away because I don't think you could top that that one time when John Paulus and the entire Fieldhouse was playing and singing along with us as we played Three Blind Mice. It was appropriate.
Over the years, and actually there's some good story. You tell a good story about actually getting the band involved in other sports other than Badger football, basketball, and hockey.
Hockey was a big thing. Bob Johnson was very important in getting established that. He started pestering me very early on. You got to have a band at a hockey game. We need you. Because hockey was just getting started as a sport. And finally, I gave in. He said, well, just come one night. We'll play a two-night series. Come one night. And we did. And he came to me the next day and said, Mike, it's too popular. You got to keep coming every night because the fans that are coming on Friday night think you should be here both nights. So it just grew, and then we went into women's basketball.
Yeah.
Then we started playing for volleyball in those days, and then women's hockey. So it was one of those things. I'm very pleased with the fact that the demand, that people felt like they wanted to have the band there, and that made me very pleased about it. Sometimes created problems because we started to spread ourselves pretty thin, but it worked.
Keith in Lake Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hello there, Larry and Mike. I want to ask Mike if you'd give a little more of a background on the Bud song and where that came from and how the crowds responded to it.
Yeah, and you've got some great stories in there about the Budweiser song, Mike.
Well, we started playing that about 1972 or... We had a group of fans in Section GG. I remember it very carefully at the old Coliseum. And every time we stopped playing, they would get together as a crowd and holler, "We want a polka! We want a polka!" And I'm from Indiana, so I didn't know much about polkas in those days. But finally, I had this tune called "You Said It All," which was a beer commercial. And I told the band, I said, well, if you change the percussion part a little bit here, if you change a little bit the attitude of it, it'll sound like a polka, they'll leave me alone. But the next game, we want a polka, we want a polka. So we started playing it on a regular basis. And then I noticed the crowd, when they got to the part about when you say ba, 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 they were using the name of the product. And I thought, well, that's not good. I'm doing advertising. So at one point, I had the band stand up, turn and face the crowd, and say, when you say Wisconsin, you've said it all. And that took a while to catch on. It was sort of a battle back and forth between the crowd. And eventually, we won them over, and it became part of the traditions. We played it everywhere. The year that they won the national championship, it just went berserk how loud it was and how much people played it and sang it.
And Budweiser, actually, as you note in your book, they even did a kind of an ad that was a tribute to the band. And
they did a commercial, a televised commercial that was not really working to sell their product. What they were trying to do is to pay a tribute to the band, which again, one of those things that you're just couldn't have planned for, but they just stepped up.
And Budweiser, I mean, they never paid you for it, but they did donate some money.
They contributed regularly both to the band fund and to the athletic department.
Yeah, so pretty cool. Karen emailed to say she was sad that she she couldn't be in the band because she played the flute and there were no flutes in the band in the 70s.
Well, that I didn't do anything about. Although you would be amazed, Larry, the number of flute players that were in the band playing other instruments. A lot of the women who were, they went to cymbal playing, which they were very natural at. A lot of the women learned to play another instrument very satisfactorily, and so they got in the band. So it didn't cut them out completely, but it did reduce the number of flute players that we were considering.
Well, I want to get this in, and we can go back to other parts. But I know you have kept going here. You may have retired, but you're not retired. You got podcasts. Talk about that.
Well, Four Seasons Theater, who I've done a lot of work with. Sarah Marty with Four Seasons Theater, she said, you should do a podcast based on the class that I used to teach at the university. It was called The Big Bands, and I did another class called Immortal Performers.
Yeah.
And she said, you need to just put that on a podcast. And I didn't know what a podcast was at that point, but she said, just talk for a half an hour. And it proved to be something that I got a kick out of doing because I got to just say the things that I had told my class during the years. And it was relatively easy for me to do it, although, as I've said many times, I've learned that you better be accurate or you have listeners that are going to let you know about it if it's not.
And so that's called Listening with Lecro.
That's right. And we've done about a dozen of them so far, and we keep trying to release them every few weeks. We try to release another one, and I think we've got four or five in the can right now that we can release, which is, it's a lot of fun, and it's good for me to have to research some of these things.
Can't let you go without talking about your entrances for the big band. I can remember you bicycling across. Where were you? You were way the heck up in the air, yeah, on a bicycle. And you weren't even.
I wasn't safetied, as they say.
You weren't safetied.
No. We stretched a wire the length of the basketball court. Up above the audience, and
yeah,
we rigged it so we could ride it the length of the field. The problem was they safetied the bike, but they didn't safety me. I just had to climb on and hope that everything went well. But I did a lot of foolish things like that, but it was fun, and it made people want to come to the concert. It was nothing else. It was, well, what's the silly guy going to do next? And that was fun for me.
You even had to jump to a fire pole.
I did. That's the one thing I probably would not do again. I had to jump off of the third deck of the field house onto a fire pole and slide all the way down. And again, something like that, you can't safety at all. You just have to do it. And I did.
Well, I tell you what, is there anything you do differently?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't think I would, because there were so many things that you look back and you say, well, if I would have been smart enough to know to do that different, things would have turned out better. But things turned out so well for me. I mean, I really feel blessed in the way that everything had happened to me over the years. So I probably wouldn't do it because it might change things that happen later.
Well, things have gone well, including this book, Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story. Mike, it's always been a pleasure. I hope this isn't our last time talking together.
I hope so, too. It's always been fun.
Mike Lecrone, his book again, Moments of Happiness, A Wisconsin Band Story. It officially opens tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And great talking with him today. I wish we had more time because there are so many stories in his book you would love to hear. Always great to have him with us, and great to have you listening in, and great to have the staff that we've got. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our producers, tech directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store.